Welcome to another edition of Sitting Around Talking Movies. I'm Neil Rosen with, as always, Bill Bregoli.
Hi there, boys and girls.
And Bill McCuddy.
Present.
So we're going to talk about this new movie that's opening in theaters this week called The Cure for Wellness. And also, we've got interviews.
Spoiler alert, it sucks.
We've got interviews with the director of that film, Gore Verbinski. And we'll talk about his other movies as well.
Like and the star.
Pirates of the Caribbean, Dane DeHaan. We've had interviews with him. We're going to talk about coming on demand this weekend on DVD, a movie called The Edge of 17, a new James Franco movie that's just coming out this week.
We should say this week's James Franco movie.
Yes, that's right. Today's James Franco movie.
You could do a podcast just about James Franco.
Called,
I'm sure you would love it.
Battle, which is based on a book by
John Steinbeck,
who did The Grapes of Wrath, for those of you who are not that
This is kind of the Apples of Wrath.
And finally... we'll also talk about, I said The Edge of 17, so I guess that's what we're doing.
All right.
We're doing, Arrival arrives on DVD this week.
If you have not seen that, you must,
but
we'll talk about that in a
minute. So before we get started, Bill McCuddy, you just came from an interesting lunch, didn't you?
The FX miniseries Feud, which launches on March 5th, talks about Bette Davis and Joan Crawford when they made Whatever Happened to Baby Jane in the early 60s. You remember
that movie? The movie about the making of that movie.
The movie about the making of the movie is an 8-part miniseries that they only showed us the first two episodes of. It's campy. It's not quite as over the top as No Wire Hangers, the Joan Crawford movie, Mommy Dearest. But guess who's Bette Davis's daughter and sat with me? Polly Draper. What was the little Draper girl? Sherpa is her last name. You know, blonde, Betty's daughter.
No, I have no idea what you're
okay.
Bill Bregoli, do you have any idea what he's doing?
You never saw Mad Men.
Usually I know Buster.
You have
Oh, Don Draper. When you Don Draper's
No, but her name, Bette Draper, I said.
Bette Draper, yes.
So their daughter wasn't Polly. What was her little, her name on the show?
Yes, I know who you're talking about.
Sally Draper. So she's charming. She's 17 now. She's just a taller version of that same kid. And she's still playing somebody's daughter. In this case, it's Bette Davis's daughter. Susan Sarandon was there. Catherine Zeta-Jones was there. Ryan Murphy, who's like the it boy of Fox and also of television right now, having just come off O.J. Simpson. We talked about that. We talked about how movies and movie stars are really looking at these 8-hour arcs because they get to work a lot more. They get to tell better stories. They get juicier lines. So it was held at the top of 30 Rock in the Rainbow Room. Which was gorgeous.
You got to tell Neil about Susan Sarandon's dress.
Susan Sarandon was in an orange jumpsuit. And she said, "It looks like I'm here to change someone's oil." And I said, "No, you look like a Bond villain henchman." And she liked that. So it was. She was stunning, by the way. Everybody was gorgeous. Jessica Lange looks like she's. I mean, she's clearly had some work, but I think she would admit that if she were sitting here. But she looked amazing, and it was a great conversation. So, lots of famous journalists there. Bill Carter, our buddy from the New York Times, who's now got a podcast himself, and Gail King was the moderator from the morning show over at CBS, and it was a great time. I sat with the great. Lisa Birnbach, who did the, do you remember in the 80s and 90s, she did the Preppy Handbook, and then she was a correspondent on CBS for a while. And so that was, it was fun. It was about several hundred people there. It was a big time.
Well, very good.
So March 5th, The Feud, very good. Tune in for it on FX.
All right, moving on.
You guys went, or actually Bill went to something just as interesting yesterday.
Ties into our first movie, too.
Our first movie.
I went to the junket for A Cure for Everything.
A Cure for Wellness. I wish it was A Cure for Everything.
Bill and I sat together at a screening of this film, and I was very impressed that they set a screening specifically for Bill Bregoli.
That's right. I had a private screening.
I walk into this screening room. There's nobody in the screening room, but the gentleman sitting on my left, Bill Bregoli.
Till you saw the movie and then you realized they'd have shown it to anyone.
And the only other person in the room was some Fox security guy.
That's standard procedure for Fox.
What is that? So they don't pirate the movie?
So you and I, who probably couldn't figure out what end of the video camera to turn on.
Don't sit there and record
Nobody's
going to want to pirate this movie because this was just awful. Let me tell you what this movie is about.
Wait, before you do that, can I just tell you the one other time there was a screening for one other person besides me, and it was the late, or I don't know if he's, is Gene Shalit still alive?
He's alive.
So it was
Apollo 13.
Apollo 13, we're at the 666s on Fifth Avenue where Universal had its screening room. And I walk in and they go, there's one other person here. It's just you two. And I'd worked at NBC at the time, so it was an NBC screening. He was in the middle, right in the middle of the theater. And so what did I do? I went right to the row in front of him. I sat right in front of him. He goes, all right, that's funny. Who the hell are you? And I turned around and introduced myself. We sat together. We watched the movie together. So tell us what
I have had
about
a screening where I've been the only one in the screening.
I think we all have.
Well, you know, that's kind of cool. Anyway, but enough of this.
Bragging about our jobs.
Yes, exactly. All right, so A Cure for Wellness. So Dane DeHaan, who you might remember, he was in this movie called A Place Beyond the Pines.
Right.
With,
is that the only thing he's done?
Was it Ryan Gosling?
Ryan Gosling.
And the guy from Brooklyn, Emery Cohen, was in that too. So anyway, here he plays this young, ladder-climbing corporate exec who the board of directors or whatever, his bosses, send him to this remote wellness spa in buried somewhere in the corner of the Swiss Alps. And to retrieve the company's CEO because the stock is going down and he's the owner. And apparently the CEO has gone crazy. So not only
he's written them a letter saying, don't come and get me, I'm done.
Right. Not only does he have to go out and just get him, he has to get him to come back. Right. So he gets to this spa and he discovers that not only are the guests not getting better in this spa, but it's the place itself, run by Jason Isaacs, that's making everybody sick there. So crazy experiments are conducted there, and making matters worse, DeHaan is soon diagnosed with the same mysterious illness that everybody else has in the place.
It's in the water.
And,
Spoiler alert.
It's always in the water. Keep drinking water.
Yeah.
And
spring, an ancient aquifer from the bay. So everybody keeps drinking water.
And despite his many attempts to escape, he can't leave.
No.
And that's the first 40 minutes.
No one ever wants to leave, they say. And yet that's what I kept saying through the whole movie. I really want out of here. Yeah. Right now.
So it's really long. It's 2.5 hours. And
more than
Bill Bergoglio and I are sitting next to each other. And we actually thought the movie ended at one particular point.
It does. No, it definitely. There's
and
a couple of endings.
And then they tack on another 25 minutes. I'm like, are you kidding? And I'm not going to spoil the movie, even though it's a horrible movie. And I do not suggest that you see this movie on any level. But when they go back in, it doesn't even, like the ending where I thought it ended, I thought, okay, it's resolved now, and then there's no reason for the character to do what he does to do another 25 minutes. It's just Dane DeHaan's point of view, let's just say, makes no sense. Stylistically, the movie looks great. I mean, this is the one thing with Gore Verbinski. I mean, the movie looks terrific. I mean, the sets, the production design, the colors.
Let's tell people who don't know, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Right. He did the Mexican, all three Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Mouse
thing. He did Rango.
Rango, which is animated.
He did Mouse Hunt. He's a styler, so we'll get to him in a minute. But it looks great. But this is not a plot guy. I mean, 45 minutes after this, the whole thing just totally hits the skids. I don't know what's going on. Worse, I don't even care what's going on. And,
I bet the stars do. And so, what did our lead actor say, Bill, when you sat down with him?
I talked to Jason Isaacs.
Who, by the way, before you even play this Jason Isaacs soundbite, I'm going to tell you that the end of this movie, the last half an hour, is so bad, it's so ridiculous that it's almost unintentionally funny. I mean, it
feels tacked on. It feels like a rewrite. There's a lot of things going on.
An hour and a half of the thing is just terrible. All right, so you spoke to Jason Isaacs,
right,
Bill.
And he said that they actually filmed the interiors of the movie in probably the most haunted location in Europe.
It's a giant compound of buildings where Hitler and all the German soldiers were rehabbed after the First World War, and there have been many murders, mass murders, and all kinds of suicides, and you can feel in the soil and in the bricks, you can feel the kind of screams and torment of the past. And I'm sure it fed into how creeped out we all were on camera.
So there's bad karma in this joint just from the get-go, and they picked it anyway.
Right. And I also talked to Dale DeHaan, and he talked about playing the lead role in a movie like this.
It's not just about being in every frame the movie and having to, you know, make a performance that people want to watch. But also in the beginning of the movie, he's not that likable of a person. So you need to take this person that's not necessarily likable and make him compelling, you know, which was the added pressure.
You know, he brings up a good point because there is no reason to root for this guy. This is something Neil said on the show today. It's like you have no idea.
A television show called Talking Pictures, which airs nationally on Time Warner Cable, Spectrum Cable.
And we watch the bad movies so you don't have to.
All right, contractual obligations are over, boys.
But
you're right. You said there's nobody to root for in this movie. It's really hard. There's like, he's an asshole in the beginning of the movie, and then he's sort of trapped, so then you feel a little worse for him, but he still wants to get his boss out of there and back to corporate America in New York. So finally he meets this young girl, which is a
huge mistake. Yeah, that's when the movie really goes down.
In my mind, if they'd just been about going to that spa, it could have been cool, but they had to drag this other story, which accounts for another hour, because it all has to be answered in the end in a creepy father-daughter expose.
Bill Bergoli told me that this Mia Goth, who's just horrible in the movie as well, but I don't blame her as much as the movie itself, is dating or married to...
She's married to Shia LaBeouf.
Right. Another wacko.
Since last October.
Right?
Really?
So,
yeah.
Well, that explains a lot.
That's what it says in IMDb.
I hated the movie. I really did.
Yeah, I can't recommend it on any level. And what I want to tell people, I think you guys will agree, is that the trailers and the television commercials, which they've been running tons of, look really good. I mean, we said it's a cool idea for the first, like, 40 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, the first 40 minutes I was sitting there, and I'm going like, all right, where's this going? This has got me involved
I went to a presentation. They had a footage presentation last December. Fox did.
I hate those footage presentations.
I know, but they
invite
showed
you and
the
it kind of ruins the movie for me.
Showed the first 40 minutes of this, smart because that's the best 40 minutes in the movie.
Well, of course, they're not going to show you the shittiest, but here's the interesting thing for me. For reasons I won't go into, eels play prominently in this motion picture. And so you said yesterday at the junket
They had a tank of eels just as a background for people doing TV interviews.
So people don't understand at home that there's like this effort on the marketing department who come up with good ideas around a table. Hey, what if we had a whole aquarium of eels at the junket? and everybody gets an eel to go home with, and then legal comes in and says, no, you can't give them an eel. What if it's an electric eel? Then they're killed. So then they don't do that. But you show up yesterday, and there's a
tank full of eels an eel wrangler.
Were you allowed to swim with the eels?
No. But the eels showed up in the men's room later when they broke the tank down. The eel guys were washing up, and they had the eels in a bucket in the men's room. I don't know if they flushed them down the toilet or what the deal was, but the eels were everywhere. And actually, Gore Verbinski talked to me about the eel wranglers on the set.
Eel wranglers are highly unusual. The next closest thing is that guy who's crawling under your house to set rat traps.
What a creepy
this
job.
This movie reminded me of, and it's not good like this movie, but it was trying, in some capacities, it was trying to be The Shining, just the way this, like, creepy abandoned hospital was this creepy abandoned hotel.
A lot of things.
You know, and it was an isolated hotel. They were both isolated, you know, isolated spa, which was kind of a hotel spa. And then it also was trying to be a little bit of Shutter Island, which is, and I didn't like Shutter Island, and this is worse than that, you know? So, I don't know.
Shutter Island had an interesting reveal that either you liked or you didn't like. This doesn't have anything.
There's a scene in this movie where they take a giant tube attached to a tank of eels and water, and they shove it down the guy's throat, which... I'm not talking about putting it down like just slightly in his throat. I mean, they the thing is the size of like a
right.
One of those hoses in the cars.
But yeah, no, like 3 or 4 inches, and you're thinking, is this going to come out the other end?
Like a big car hose or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what it's called.
I don't know. You know cars.
Like
anyway,
a duct?
I don't know, but it's a huge hose the size of like maybe.
3 or 4 inches, I said.
A bottle of water or something like that. And the way they shove it down, it's like maybe they put 4 feet of the thing down.
As I said, I was expecting it to come out another end.
That would kill anybody. You couldn't just do that.
That's the first unrealistic thing that happens in the movie?
No,
this is like an hour and a half
you just
in?
You couldn't do that. I mean,
And then they force feed them eels. And I'm thinking, even if you like sushi.
Right. Which I do.
This is
like
not
eel.
Unpleasant. So can the eels hurt you? Because there's a couple of scenes where people are in tanks with eels. Do they bite?
I don't know about the movie, the eels at the junket.
Then it morphs into Phantom of the Opera at the end of the whole thing.
It's kind of a big Vincent Price haunted house movie at the ridiculous. End, which is kind of weird.
So Gore Verbinski, you know, the guy who directed this, I have to tell you, so as we said earlier, like his movies, most well-known for those Pirates of the Caribbean movies, you know? He did The Ring as well, and The Lone Ranger, which tanked at the box office. You know, I think this guy is, I don't know if you'd agree, he's really great stylistically, but he's not a plot guy.
I said he's a director of photography. He should be a DP, but
he
not
should.
A
He'd
director.
Be a great DP. He yeah. cannot direct movies. He has no interest in story and grabbing you in. I mean, all those Pirates of the Caribbean movies, aside from the first one, which I didn't think was great, but at least it was understandable on some level. The second and third one, I had no idea what was going on in those movies.
Right.
Yeah, do they look
They're
good?
Just giant sets that look good and have...
Does it look good? Does it capture the era of the pirate? Yes, but do you really have any idea what's going on? And
if we can agree that Johnny Depp has sold out, which can't we for these Pirates of the Caribbean movies, why would we think the director is any different? His job is to make the star happy.
Just the way, you know, you mentioned
they
this
did
on the
Rango
show.
Together. They
you
did...
Know, just the way Scorsese and De Niro and now Scorsese and DiCaprio are a team, or the way Ridley Scott and Russell Crowe are a team. Yes, so they're a team. They like working with each other.
They did Lone Ranger, they did Rango, and they did all the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. Do you think Johnny Depp will make another movie with this man after this?
Do you think that is... I don't know. Do you think that this guy's... If this movie tanks at the box office, considering that Lone Ranger tanked at the box office, do you think that
it's
we're
tough.
Done with Gore Verbinski as a director? Because M. Night Shyamalan, like, did Signs, and that's great. And then every other movie subsequently...
Well, he's back, sort of.
Yeah, so, I mean, but they kept giving him chance after chance after chance.
Yeah.
So,
I think what they'll do with this guy is keep reducing his budgets. He'll get smaller and smaller and smaller budgets because they just can't bank on him, definitely. I don't think this is going to be a hit. No. Let me just go out on a limb here.
It's coming out of this time of year, it's not going to be a hit.
Will it have a good opening weekend?
No, I think Bad Buzz is going to get around pretty quickly.
Well, they're advertising the shit out of it on television.
Right.
I did watch the Super Bowl, but I don't remember seeing if there was an ad for this on the Super Bowl.
I don't think so, but it's been all around.
But anything you watch, you see an ad for this thing. So, you know, it might just, marketing is a big tool. I mean, it might just, people.
But
like
that only works for one weekend. And then if it has like a 70% fall off in the second weekend.
It only works for Thursday night.
I'm saying it could work for half a weekend because then people could get on Twitter and Facebook going, this sucks.
Right.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It doesn't even work for a whole weekend anymore. Now in social media, you could just... You could just write anything you want, you know.
Everybody's a critic.
Sad.
So pass on that.
Right.
People could just write sad.
Thank goodness there's some good things on demand.
Well, so let's talk about, before we get to a really good thing on demand, I want to talk about another new movie that opens up on demand and in theaters. It's called In Dubious Battle, and it's based on it's John Steinbeck's very first book and one of his least known works. Most known for The Grapes
of Wrath.
I'd
never heard of it.
But he did Steinbeck did a Depression-era trilogy of Mice and Men and Grapes of Wrath. And this was the first one, In Dubious Battle, and it was about apple pickers in California, in Southern California. I believe it was Southern California. You know, it was in the 30s, and there were no unions, and they were told to come out to the promised land of California, which is very much like Grapes of Wrath.
Right.
There were these Okies who, like, you know, go out to California, you know. So they go out to California, and Robert Duvall, who's the boss at this apple orchard, decides he's going to pay the workers $1 a day. And he says, well, you promised $3 a day. And they're kind of stuck. They came from, like, the other side of the country, which was not an easy thing to do when you have no money. And, you know, and
well, as they all say, they spent everything they had to get there.
Right. So James Franco,
they're living in camps.
Who directed and stars in this thing, who I believe, by the way, was very miscast. I don't mind his directorial abilities.
Although I disagree only in that this is sort of the cream of the crap for him recently. Like, this is the best of what
good.
He's made
He captures
recently.
That look of the Depression.
And he's got every... You mentioned Duvall. He's got Selena Gomez. He's got Bryan Cranston.
Bryan Cranston shows up at the end of the movie for 5 minutes. Took me right out of the movie.
It's like amazing how he got all of these
Vincent
people.
DiNofrio.
Sam Shepard. Every 5 minutes, a new star shows
John
up in this.
Savage,
Josh Hutcherson,
Ed
from,
Harris. It's crazy. But all these people are in the movie for like 10 minutes. I thought that, again, like A Cure for Wellness, although not as bad as that, I was interested in it for the first, like, half, and then it just becomes really kind of boring and a slog to get through. And I don't know if that's a fault of the novel, because I didn't read the novel, but, you know, it just becomes kind of like meanders along and, you know, and...
It's not horrible, and we sort of recommend it with an asterisk, right?
If you're a John Steinbeck fan or are interested in the Depression, and
I think it's interesting enough just as being the third to this trilogy. I didn't know that there was. I mean, obviously, people have seen
Both
Of Mice and Men
known,
and Grapes of Wrath, and so
and
it fills also, that out.
And it's also, you know, it's before there were any unions. It's the birth of the labor movement in this country. I mean,
right.
People were getting the shit kicked out of them just for saying we're going on strike. I mean, there was no protection whatsoever.
A lot of people do get
and
the shit kicked out.
And it seemed to be lawless.
Some people get killed in this movie.
I mean, guy goes like, we need more wages, and they kill the guy. And the law is completely like, does nothing. It seems like it's a complete Wild West lawless society where if you have money and power, you could just kill anybody. And if the workers beat somebody up, all of a sudden there's 100 cops on their ass, and it's like, you are trespassing. And so, you know, I don't know how much of that is true, but...
I don't know. I'm taking most of it. It doesn't say anything I wouldn't have believed would
happen. The movie
doesn't
really end well, and I don't mean end well in terms of the fate of the characters, although that happens to be true. I just mean it just doesn't end well. You said on the show today there's just like a postscript.
Yeah, it felt like they didn't have enough money.
The
movie builds to a big confrontation that just never happens.
Instead,
someone dies, which is supposed to be the big ending, and then there's just a bunch of type on the screen going, this changed everything. The unions were formed shortly after that.
1.5 million people went on strike during this era in history. And most of them lost.
Right.
And many died.
Right.
It was the birth. Yeah. I mean,
so it's an upbeat ending.
That was more interesting than the last half an hour of the movie. I mean, but I thought Selena Gomez was miscast. I mean, here she is. They can't afford, like, one penny to get a hot bowl of soup. And she's there with this, $400. She just gives birth to a baby. And she's poor as dirt. And she's got this $400 layered haircut, you know, where, like, everything is, like, every hair.
All right,
like,
Jose Bear.
She doesn't look like she is missing any meals.
Right, but did you know? Yeah, exactly. But did you notice that hair? Like, the hair was like this glamour.
Well, she looked beautiful in the whole movie. I mean, she was made up and things that people wouldn't have had.
But that haircut looked like she came out of one of these designer salons, like looking to the Oscar. And I'm going, and I mean, literally, she just gives birth to a baby. They're all like covered in dirt. They don't have any food. Yeah, you're right. She doesn't look like she's starving, and she looks like she could do a modeling shoot 10 minutes you know, we've got you for an hour today, Selena, but I've got to do my Cosmopolitan cover shoot after this. Don't worry, you'll be great, and all you need is a touch-up. So I thought that was all. But it's not – I would recommend it, like you said, Bill McCuddy, with an asterisk. It's okay, but it's not great. But here's a movie that is great, that comes out on DVD this week and comes on demand this week that I loved, called The Edge of 17.
Who told you about this movie?
Did you?
I did. I was telling you guys, you got to see this movie. I went to a screening.
Haley Joel Steinfeld is... Is it Haley Steinfeld? Sorry.
No, it's Haley Steinfeld.
Steinfeld.
A friend of mine calls her the Hebrew school hottie.
Right. She is kind of weird hot. I mean,
you want to say what it's about?
Bill Bergoli.
All right.
You told us about it. Tell us about it again.
I'll do it again. Takes the lead, my friend.
Sam Jackson
just
joined us.
This teenage girl whose father passed away earlier in her life. She's being brought up by her mother, and she feels.
Kira Sedgwick.
Right. She's awkward and doesn't have any friends. Finally, she gets a friend, a nice girl who, as it turns out, is getting physical with her brother.
That's correct.
Just totally freaks her out. She feels like this is a betrayal.
With Haley Joe Steinfeld's
brother.
Right, Haley Steinfeld. Haley Joe.
And
Bobby Sue.
This upsets her terribly, so she confides in the one friendly teacher in the entire school, played by Woody Harrelson.
Very funny.
And
very good job.
I think. It's a wonderful little relationship.
He's kind of like very mean to her, but he does it in a kind of like fun way. And
right. She comes in and says, I want to commit suicide. And he says, well, I'm going to read you my suicide note. And his suicide note says that he's going to kill himself because this girl keeps bothering him and she's very badly dressed. And
it's funny. It's like she comes in, she's, I'm hysterical. I can't see. Can you see I'm eating lunch?
You can tell from the get-go that she's one of his favorite students and that they have a relationship that is based on, that he's kind of picked her out as like a teacher's pet in a weird way.
Yeah.
And they have sort a weird relationship.
Not a creepy
it's
way.
Not a creepy
way.
No, no.
Comes and picks her up. Yeah, there's nothing weird about it, which is very cool.
No, but what I love, first of all, she's Haley Steinfeld, not Joe
Steinbaum.
Haley Steinfeld is great. And, you know, there's a lot of coming-of-age movies, and most of them suck. And this is not like some frivolous Porky's kind of coming-of-age.
Not at all.
Or what was the one where they did three of them, the American Pie
kind
of?
No.
This is way above. One reason is that James Brooks, the great James Brooks, was one of the
executives.
James Joe Brooks was the...
He served
on the executive
producer.
Directed
and written
by a woman.
He was a producer, and he served as a mentor to first-time writer-director Kelly Freeman Craig.
Kelly Joe Freeman Craig.
Right, that's right. And, you know, these characters, you know, are real. That's the thing that struck me. I mean, this teenage angst that she's going through, this is not some bullshit thing where, like, let's all get laid. And there's a scene with her where, you know, she's betrayed by her friend where she just wants to hook up with this hottie guy in school and sends, like, drunk texts to this guy. And
he takes her up on it. And that's a great scene.
And her text?
That is a scene that is just, like, I mean, you cringe in pain watching this scene.
Can we just go see a movie? Can we, like, catch a movie? He's like, wait, you invited me out to the... Like, she's
That's
culpable
amazing.
For half. It's really well done. It's really, really well done.
And then
done.
There's another scene that I like. I mean, just little things like this where she's complaining to some, was it Woody Harrelson's character or somebody? She's going, I don't relate to anybody in my generation. She goes, I don't know, everybody's got phones. And they seem to want to, like, say everything that's going on in their life. And she goes, I just ate a taco, smiley emoji. Who gives a fuck, she writes. You know what she says? And it's so true. It's like all these teenagers are doing that. It's like, yeah, it's like, who cares? That much about
that feels
your
a little
life.
Bit like an older person wrote that, but I understand what you're saying. I think that what the point here is, this is head and shoulders above even a very good John Hughes movie.
Way better than a John Hughes movie. The only great teenage movie that I've seen other than this movie, next to this movie, there's two great ones. The Spectacular Now, which is also on demand and is also on DVD with Miles Teller and Shailene Woodley, which I highly recommend.
I also like Diary of a Teenage Girl.
That's the other one I was going to mention with Alexander Skarsgård.
Right. Alexander and, Joe Skarsgård.
And I'm sorry, the name of the girl escapes me, but I should give her props. As a matter, I'm going to look up her name because she was so good in that. But that is weird movie about a teenage girl who experiences sex for the first time by having sex with her mother's boyfriend. Diary of or Confessions of?
Diary.
And Diary of a
Teenage Girl. The boyfriend was...
the girl, I said Alexander Skarsgård. Belle Powley is the girl that played, who's English, and Kristen Wiig was the mom. And
And
apparently Christopher Maloney, who I don't remember, is in this movie,
too. Yeah, he's her dad.
But Belle Powley, what's she doing now? She's got six upcoming projects.
All right.
The Bell Jar, that was a famous thing. That's coming out. Well, she's terrific in that.
Do you remember Haley Steinfeld's first movie?
Well,
she's in the remake of True Grit.
Yeah.
But did she do anything before that?
I don't think so.
I think in True Grit, she was Haley Joe Steinfeld.
She's so great in this. I can't speak highly enough of this. And on a last note, a movie that have we talked about Arrival?
I think when it came out,
when
we did.
It came out in theaters.
Yeah,
well, it's
absolutely.
On DVD.
Don't call
that
a head scratcher.
It's on DVD.
Well, I said
week.
Some people are. But it still made my top 10, and I encourage
did
anyone.
Did you like it, Bregoli?
I liked it.
Yeah, I liked it. I did think it got slow in the middle. You know, and as I said on the TV show today, 12 mysterious spacecrafts land at different points all over the Earth. And I think that in a real-life situation, they wouldn't give the linguists 3 months to try to learn how to communicate with these aliens.
Not with the president we have now.
That's what I said
on
the show today.
Things,
said,
right.
Thank you, President Trump.
Right. I think they would fire on these things immediately. But that said, it really is...
She's kind of Dr. Doolittle. She talks to the aliens.
Yes,
and
it has an ending that makes you think, which is great.
Oh, the whole thing
is stupid action bullshit.
No, it's great.
And it also says a lot about, makes me think about language and like what language is, because that's really, you know, when you think about words.
How we interpret things and how they're different for other people.
Right,
and
you would just think that that the aliens would have a language. But what is language? If you and I never really stopped to think about that. And as I said on the show, you know, is it the most thought-provoking sci-fi thing I've ever seen? No, but it's good, and I give the guy credit. And let's talk about stylistically with Gore Verbinski, the director of Arrival, whatever his name is.
Denis
Villeneuve.
Villeneuve.
Yeah, that, it's just, that is a directorial effort.
He did Sicario last year.
I mean, that is just beautiful to look at, the inside of the alien spacecraft. And
think about how many movies, even Close Encounters of a Third Kind and E.T., where they get the aliens wrong.
Yeah.
And these are weird looking too, but they're totally believable.
And they're doing they communicate through Jackson Pollock splatter paints.
Right.
Well, there's always that stock alien, which is what I hated about that Michael Shannon movie that we reviewed a couple of. It's like it's that Close Encounters alien, that Roswell alien. It's that like skinny little thing. Right. Do you remember in that Michael Shannon movie, which was directed by the guy who did Mud and What's the last movie that guy did, the Mud guy? He just did something else too. I don't like this director. But yeah, he has it's that stock alien. You know what I mean? Right. It's like and these two
it's
aliens.
It's one alien working.
Abbott
works all the time.
Abbott and
he's got a great agent.
He's got a great gig.
He just shows up. Okay, this time you're from the future.
Right.
And
well, the director
you're
of
Jewish, which is kind of unusual. And
that's right. Well, the director of Mud, who I don't care for his work. His name.
You liked Mud, didn't you?
Jeff Nichols. Well, that's the best of the bunch, but I wasn't dancing over it. But he did Mud. He did Take Shelter. Was the other movie that I was thinking about.
Take Shelter is a great movie.
Another Michael Shannon movie.
Michael Shannon in that too.
And but, didn't he do Loving?
No.
Well, it says he did. He said he's known for Loving.
Just
IMDb.
Means in general, he's a sweet guy.
He directed Loving.
Okay, and what was the? But what's the
movie that I?
What's
think
the Michael Shannon weird? It's like
I told you, you're not listening.
Like
to
Tomorrow,
me.
What?
You're
no.
not listening to me.
With
I
the
told
alien,
you the movie was called Take Shelter.
No. That's a different movie. The alien one is different.
Oh, you're talking about Midnight Special?
Midnight Special. That's what that was called.
Another real terrible
Kirsten Dunst,
film.
Yeah.
That wasn't horrible.
That's
it was
the one with the horrible alien.
Yes, that's what I'm telling you. It's
that,
not Take Shelter.
That's what I'm
We're two
you.
Old men sitting in the
that's
with the.
What I'm saying.
Wait a minute, dear.
I saw a documentary the other day.
Oh boy.
That is called The Last Laugh, and it's about Jews, the humor, and the Holocaust. And everybody's in this thing. Mel Brooks, Jeffrey Ross, Carl Reiner, Sarah Silverman. And they're all talking, and survivors from the Holocaust, talking about whether they used humor as a survival tool while they were in the concentration camps. This is a very
Mel Brooks is
movie.
Also in that.
Well, Mel Brooks talks about.
No, I wanted you to yell at me and say you'd already said that, but you didn't take the bait.
I just was going to.
Mel Joe that. Brooks.
But Mel Brooks makes an interesting point that when the producers came out originally, people were very offended by the movie. And then when it came out on Broadway as a musical, like 30 years later, or maybe 35, 40 years later, whatever it was, it was acceptable time. It's comedy plus, what is it?
Tragedy
plus time equals comedy.
Right.
And then somebody actually addresses that and says, I don't even know what the hell that means. But he said that if you had done Springtime for Osama back then that you would have gotten the same flack. But
maybe.
I don't know. But,
I don't know. The whole thing that now is too soon. Like, everybody jumps on anything as soon as somebody dies.
Gilbert Gottfried, who's your friend, Gilbert Gottfried, got fired from the Affleck commercials.
Right, for tweeting about a tsunami in Japan.
The tsunami joke,
right?
Ready gets the lie.
But he also...
They should build a library here. Don't worry. It'll be here in 5 minutes.
They built a documentary around him for telling a joke, the Aristocrats.
Yeah.
Because he went to the Hugh Hefner roast.
He was at the Hefner
right
roast.
After 9/11 and told a joke about... saying I want to go to Los Angeles, but the only flight I could get stops at the Empire State Building. And that just turned the crowd on him.
I know.
And he went and told the Aristocrats instead.
And that was not planned to do the Aristocrats, right? That
was his fallback. Things go bad, send
them. If this happens.
Right. That was just his fallback.
The daughter's drinking the father's, and then the father gets the white.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think there's now absolutely no chance that Gilbert Gottfried will ever do this podcast.
I would like Gilbert Gottfried.
Well, we'd love to. Gilbert, the door is open. The
so
sliding
next week
glass door is open.
We're going to be doing you don't want to miss it. It's our Oscar prediction show, where we're going to tell you if you have an office pool, If you know a bookie, we are very good at picking winners.
If you don't know a bookie, I can get you one.
I don't know any bookies. I'm not advocating illegal gambling. But I think it's legal now. Isn't it like in Jersey you could place – or in Vegas?
Well, in Vegas, you've always been able to.
They can do sports fantasy teams. We could do a movie fantasy thing. And
well,
probably
anyway.
That's – probably somebody will build.
I'm going to make a bold prediction about Best Picture next week, and I'm not going to. And I'm
well,
not. That's not what you think.
The category to watch is Casey versus Denzel. That's the category to watch. That's up in the air.
I got a theory about something else that can. And believe me, as you mentioned this luncheon earlier, I talked to 4 Academy members today, and they're not voting for what you think they're voting for. So we'll talk about
next week. Ooh, a teaser. So for Bill Bregoli,
yes.
And Bill McCuddy,
I'm still here,
and Neil Rosen. Thanks for sitting around talking movies. And next week on our Oscar prediction show, we'll sit around talking Oscars with you on Sitting Around Talking Movies. We'll see you then. We'll see you then, but it's audio. So what do you say, Bill?
You'll hear us next week.
You'll hear us then. Take care.